Hi, everyone. So my next guest is a registered family psychotherapist with particular expertise in relationships, sex therapy and addiction. Based in Dundrum, he runs an extremely successful private practice and has worked with over 12,000 couples to date. He makes regular appearances on media broadcasters such as News Talk, RTE, and was involved in the six-part TV programme You're Not the Man I Married on the BBC. His book, Love Rewired, Using Your Brain to Mend Your Heart, explains how we can improve our family relationships by better understanding our brains and can be found at all leading booksellers. Referred to as Ireland's best-known dating coach, I'm sure we have a lot to unfold. David Kavanagh, thank you for coming on the podcast. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. My pleasure. Good to hear. Thank you for having me here.
So I'm going to start with the sexual health and relationships aspect because we don't get many experts in this area. Is Ireland well educated on good sexual health and relationships?
I wouldn't think we are. I think there's a huge gap in our knowledge and understanding, especially from the couples that I work with in their early 20s and, you know, mid-30s as the case may be. People have gone through the educational system, which has largely been dominated by the Catholic Church. Therefore, there's particularly, a skewed understanding of what the purpose of sex is, which is that it's for procreation, and that the enjoyment of sex has been almost been sucked out of the concept completely, to such a point where, you know, especially down the country where I've worked with couples in various different regional areas, regional hubs, people have a very strange idea about what the purpose of sex is for, and whether or not as a couple you are really allowed to enjoy it, or if you're supposed to feel ashamed of yourselves still, even in 2020. And that's a huge challenge. So I think the educational system, which is largely dominated by the Catholic Church, still suffers from that idea that we can't really encourage children to grow into adults who enjoy sex for sex's sake. But there has to be some other hidden agenda behind what we teach them. And the problem there is that children are accessing pornography from ridiculously young ages of 11, 12, 13. And so they're not really necessarily listening to their teachers or to their parents, who don't really talk about it in the first place. But there's this education that's being, through osmosis, young people are assuming that what they see in pornography is actually, because it's in film, it must be an accurate representation of what a healthy sex life really is.
Yeah.
So the young adults that come to me, who if they've escaped pornography addiction, but have watched pornography for 5 or 6 years as their source of education, they believe that the physical act of sex done the way that they see on television or on their smartphones, they think that that physical representation is a true reflection of what you can expect from intimacy with somebody.
Yeah.
There's no mind connection. There's no emotional connection. It's just purely physical. And it's all about the acts that you do during sex and the quality of the range of acts that you're prepared to perform.
Yeah.
Which gives young girls particularly a very, very negative view of themselves.
Mm.
It's based around what young men think they're capable or willing to perform. I think it's really dangerous, actually.
Yeah, it's funny. So it's kind of moved from being overly dominated in the Catholic Church to overly dominated by pornography now. It's changed, but it still hasn't improved. Was that?
Yeah, I think they're two polar opposites.
Yeah.
On the same fulcrum, shall we say, that swings in different ways around a misunderstanding of what the fullness of sexuality should be.
Mm.
And that, when it comes to education then, if I'm working with a couple where the guy's premature ejaculation or erection difficulties, usually couples have no idea as to the mechanics of sex.
Yeah.
Because they've watched pornography, it was never discussed in school, and in pornography the guy is erect immediately.
Mm.
So because of that, men just presume that their erection should happen at exactly the same frequency and with the same time frame. And women are equally frustrated because men don't do that, because that's not normal.
Yeah.
So, you know, the couple themselves get into a situation where she feels he's inadequate, he feels stupid, they don't talk about it, and their sex life dissipates completely.
Mm.
That's not good.
So when you have couples coming in, I know obviously it's never a one size fits all, but what would be the most common issues? Would it generally be related to sex, or would it be...
For couples work... So the couples work that come in isn't all sex related.
Okay.
It would be communication issues. There's a lot of affairs and adultery, or boundaries have been broken in terms of the expectations people had of relationships that they, you know, they imagined it was going to be a certain way, and then it's not, and they're disappointed. Especially if you have children, a lot of couples expect to be happy when they have three children running around their house all day every day, and they want the romance and the lifestyles that they had before they had kids. And I'm kind of saying, look, you can't have that. you know, for the next 20 odd years, you're going to be miserable.
Yeah.
And when I say that kind of jokingly, they kind of both breathe a sigh of relief and go, oh, God, phew, really? It's not just us. No, you're not supposed to be happy. And they go, ah, OK, cool. And they go off and they reevaluate their relationship in light of the fact that you're not supposed to be that happy.
Yeah.
Or to have that, you're not supposed to have mind blowing sex when you can't make space because your child is going to burst in your bedroom door at any point. How are you supposed to have spontaneous sex at that point? You can't. It's impossible.
Hmm.
So when people are realistic about their relationship and what they should expect from each other and from being married, they're likely to be much happier as a consequence of being realistic.
Okay. And with COVID now, is your demand gone up? Do you feel that there's going to be more relationship issues as a result of the lockdown, the inability to leave the house as much?
Demand is through the roof.
Mm.
Because I think what's happened is people who have used work and workaholism to avoid each other, or their children to avoid each other, have now had to spend 3 months in the same very small, potentially very small confined space. And they realize that they are rubbing each other up completely the wrong way. And they don't have the tools to name that and to navigate through that process. Because all they've used is the avoidance tool. You go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. You come back at 6. We don't have to talk to each other. You spend 2 hours on your smartphone. I will put the kids to bed. And then we just continue our lives like that.
Mm.
Now what's happened is they have to spend time cooking, cleaning, eating, looking after the children together. And a lot of people realize they can't do it.
So yeah.
Now they're coming for therapy.
And do you feel, so you mentioned this avoidance through work. Do you feel that avoidance is as a result of people aren't prepared to go into this serious relationship or to have children before it happens?
100%.
Would that be the main reason?
I think so. I think the idea that we have that is culturally populated is that any two human beings who meet, find each other attractive, fall in love, have sex, can now get married and live for 40 years happily.
Yeah.
That's absolute nonsense. Pure and utter rubbish. And when I talk to people about the stupidity of it, they're like, yeah, I suppose when you think about it. Because we're not trained, we're not schooled well by our families. In many cases, definitely not in our schools, and certainly not by the media in terms of how to do healthy relationships.
Mm.
You pick up any men's magazine today, any women's magazine today, and you look at the kind of features that are being written about sex and relationships, and they're sensationalist, and they're designed to grab the attention. Are they designed to be helpful? Maybe, but they're mainly designed to sell the magazine. So I often have women and men coming to me with ideas that they've gotten from magazines. They've never tested them. They've just put them into practice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like a woman might read an article like, you know, if he really loves you, he'll do A, B, C, D, and E, F, G, you know. And if he's not, if the guy isn't doing 26 different things for every letter of the alphabet every day, she's disappointed in him.
Hmm.
So she criticizes him and picks on him, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's not okay. So I think from an educational perspective, Ireland lacks an understanding of what relationships really mean and just how lucky you can be actually if you start off with a relationship and you manage to make it to 60, 70 years of age with the same person. That takes a huge amount of compatibility and skill and luck to a large extent.
Yeah. So the title now of the SPHE subsection in the education is Sex and Relationships Education. Which seems to be good that they're clarifying that that is important, that they've subsectioned it. But going down to the very, very basics, like, now I know this is a big question, but starting off, what do you think is important for, let's say, young adolescents to know about relationships? We'll start with the relationships aspect and then we'll move to the sex.
Okay, so I think there's a point to be made for helping children to understand. This is very challenging and very difficult, but
yeah.
we learn about relationships from our parents. Ultimately, they're the first port of call for that information. If our parents' relationship is broken, if we've never met our father, if we don't, you know, if our mother is very conflictual with our father, if he's around, that's going to be a huge, it's going to have a huge impact on what we perceive to be a normal relationship. So I think we need to help young people to understand what a healthy relationship is, but also bearing in mind the fact that what they're going home to every day will be completely at odds in many, many families as to what we're teaching them.
Mm.
Now, if that's the case, if you're in a school system, for example, and you're in first year and you're 12 or 13 years of age and you do a module in an educational program, whether it's run by the school or by an external company like yourselves, and you're learning about what a healthy relationship is, and you go home to your parents and you see them doing exactly none of the things that you've just learned about in your workshop, how do you manage your response to that?
Yeah.
As a 12-year-old, to discover your father is an absolute and your mother is a complete nutter. And then what do you do? Because that's going to cause an emotional perturbance in your understanding of who you are and your family. So I think that piece is very important, that as educators, we understand that what we're suggesting to young people about what's a healthy relationship, if it's at odds with what their life experience is, they will have cognitive dissonance. Mm. They won't be able to take that on board.
Yeah.
They will shut out the information, potentially, and they will go back to reverting to what their family is telling them is a healthy relationship.
So do you think it's possible? So my opinion on this now would be that at around adolescence, at around 14 or 15, the child does have the potential to start moving away from the family. So if they're from a broken home, for example, they do have the ability to realize, well, maybe how my mother or how my father lives is not correct. So do you feel that education at a secondary school level could correct it, this to improve children's understandings of relationships?
Absolutely. If, you know, if the child is of a certain age and maturity level, and if the culture within the classroom, this is very important, if the culture within the classroom is supportive of young people's emotional development and growth, which isn't always the case. You know, sometimes when a teenager says, yes, sir, or yes, miss, I understand what you're saying. Are you saying, sir, that X, Y, and Z is the case? And the teacher confirms that, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. And all the other kids in the class start laughing and joking and taking the mic out of that particular individual. Now, they've got the awareness, but have they got the support within the classroom?
Yeah.
And if the teacher says nothing to the class but allows that person to be isolated for having that awareness, then the idea, the value of awareness becomes a devalue, because you become diminished as a teenager for having awareness. So I think the culture of the classroom is also equally as important, not just the quality of the program itself.
Yeah.
But how does the staff and the management team in that school support the ideas that you're trying to encourage young people to adopt?
Yeah, it's also very difficult for teachers, I feel, to go from like teaching geography, teaching maths, to getting very, what we would understand as personal, like talking about impotence or talking about premature ejaculation, for example. Would you have any advice for teachers about how to make that jump or how to communicate it better?
See, I think that goes back to the training institutions for teachers. Mm. And I think it goes back to the emotional development of teachers themselves.
Yeah.
If you have a 25-year-old, whatever age, doesn't matter, but if you have an emotionally immature 25-year-old man or woman who is trying to discuss premature ejaculation or erectile dysfunction, and that person goes absolutely scarlet red when they mention the word penis,
yeah,
then the whole class just sees redness and goes, oh my God. Mm. And they will destroy the teacher potentially.
Yeah.
How did you get past that? So you can imagine what it would do to a teacher's character if they are not robust enough in terms of confidence levels to take the slagging on. And I've worked with many teachers in the past. I've visited many schools when I was doing school retreats a long time ago. And the vast majority of teachers I worked with, because I was never really a teacher as such, I was always kind of an external to a school. The vast majority of teachers, bar a couple of exceptions, were incredibly anxious about what people, and especially the students, thought about them. So if we're going to help teachers to deliver an educational program about sex, then they themselves have to be robust enough to take the slagging that's probably coming their way if they get read. Because, I mean, even as a sex therapist, you know, I don't like using the word masturbation necessarily, yeah, or penis or vagina or vulva. These are words that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
You don't go to the local pub and talk about your erection difficulties. No one does.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for teachers to do it as well.
And so it's going to take a huge societal change to kind of move away from that. Obviously, it's going to take time. Do you feel it's improving? Like, even not specifically with children, but with the couples who you have coming in, there's obviously still a shame there, but do you think it's getting better at the moment?
Yes. I say yes tentatively, because it's very difficult to do a qualitative analysis of the amount of people coming in and their levels of shame. But certainly, I guess the other way of looking at it is that the people who are prepared to come for therapy are open enough to the ideas that a therapist is going to suggest to them. What I'd be concerned about is the vast majority of couples who are living unhappily engaging sex lives. It's mediocre sex, but neither of them are aware enough that of the fact that there's better sex available to them.
Mm.
Maybe they'll watch a Netflix documentary on tantric sex or something and think, oh, you never tried tantric sex. And off they go. But at the other hand, you know, if you're not talking to a professional, and if the level of training that professionals like ourselves get around sexual issues isn't of the highest standards possible, then we can't expect, as therapists, we can't expect other people to just get it.
Yeah.
A talk show is great, and I've done many, many talk shows, and, you know, it depends on the talk show host's bias, which depending on, you know, the certain names in the media industry have certain biases, which we all know about, which is fine. And, you know, those listeners will be attracted to that bias because they share the same bias. But in many cases, there isn't enough opportunities for people to discuss their attitudes and values about sex, which I would love to see happening at an adult level, not just at a educational piece in schools. But I would love some format where adults themselves felt okay to discuss sex.
Yeah.
And to really bring it into an open debate.
And I have an assumption that you can probably answer. It's probably, the shame is definitely far more towards males than females. Would I be right in saying that?
How do you mean exactly?
As in, like, males would definitely prefer not to talk about their sex life. Correct. As much as women.
Correct.
And I also, the reason why I was particularly interested in talking to you is the fact that you were male in the sex therapist role. Like, are you in minority there particularly?
Yeah, but there's not a huge amount of people who are male, I think, who are comfortable necessarily working in that field. Now, there's more men than there was 20 years ago. More men in the industry, which is great. But in terms of you answering your first question, like there has not been any Sex and the City program for men that liberates men from the ideas and fears and attitudes that have held us back and repressed us around sex.
Yeah,
there is a narrative out there at the moment that all men are potential rapists, that all men are potential abusers. And in the dating world, you know, the apps that exist, a lot of female friends of mine have said that the questions they are asked by single men to send certain types of photographs without ever even having exchanged numbers, it's disgusting. It's disgrace. And that reinforces the idea that men are potential rapists. So what does that do to sexuality? If that's what women come to the table with, believing that, you know, this guy that wants to meet me for dinner is possibly going to rape me.
Mm.
How does that affect sex and sexuality? She's hardly going to expect a happy, healthy sexual relationship with that guy.
Yeah.
So I think there are wider issues at stake in terms of the narratives that we have around men and women and the dominance and power differences between them. And until that's addressed, sex is in there somewhere. I'm not sure where exactly.
Yeah. And I'm glad now you brought up the dating app. So this is something that's obviously exploded in the past maybe decade. How has that changed the psychology of relationships when people meet, for example, through Tinder and they're in long-term relationships? Do you feel there's a dynamic there that changes?
Oh, well, what I've noticed since I started doing dating coaching when I was 30, a number of years ago, what I've noticed is that, there used to be a belief system that women were attracted to men with nice personalities or good personalities, you know, the bad boy, but it was a personality.
Yeah.
Tinder has changed all that and Bumble have changed all that completely. We now have women matching men purely on looks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 25 years ago, if you said to a woman, why did you choose your husband? Oh, he's a great sense of humor. Oh, he's very kind. Lovely chap. No, you probably chose him because of looks.
Yeah.
But now women, but even still, women are reluctant to acknowledge the fact that they're as superficial as we are.
Right.
They are attracted to the guy in the gym gear, lifting the heavy weights, as opposed to the guy that's just, you know, holding a pint glass up to his face. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that has changed. Women are far more masculine. And sex is far more non-gender specific than we thought it was in terms of how we perceive attraction, for example. Also, I think one of the very negative downsides to it is the disposable nature that dating apps kind of lend themselves to thinking about relationships. So if you meet somebody, you match with somebody, I should say, you meet them, you have numbers exchanged, et cetera, then you can stop. You can just ghost that person. So you have a wonderful date. The guy buys dinner. You go 50-50, as the case may be. And then, you know, you might snog at the end of the date. And the guy never hears from the girl ever again.
Yeah.
As far as he's concerned, he's about to fall in love with her.
Mm.
And she's disappeared. And women don't think there's any issue with that whatsoever. 25 years ago, if we could rewind time, every woman in this country who was dating would say she hated the idea of the guy not ringing her after they were together.
Yeah.
She'd go nuts at that idea. Now they're doing it to men all the time. And they don't see the problem.
In a way, though, so you're making the point. I'm glad you've made the point, though. It has become more equal. Like, there's obviously the positives and the negatives, but it's still become more equal between males and females. Would you agree?
Yeah. I would think so.
Yeah.
And I think it's good that we get to see, you know, what human beings are capable of, and that the nature and the associated personality traits that we've associated with gender, male, female traits, they're socially constructed. They are created by society for us to understand who we are.
Yeah.
And then it only takes a progression in technological advances for us to realize that actually they're not necessarily applicable anymore.
Mm.
The women are just as superficial. They like men with a certain type of style of look, and they're just as dismissive of men and as callous as men. If they don't find a guy attractive after date six, gone. He's gone. Whereas he's like, but we have a relationship. We have something. We have a thing. She's like, no, I just can't.
Do you think that's biological though? As in, that's not a fault of a person when they're basically more objectifying males or females?
I think human nature is to find pleasure in dating and to find pleasure in sex. And if it means you scroll through a dating app and you match with 20 people and you've seen 100. And in any given day, you've gotten some pleasure. Your dopamine levels have increased.
Mm.
Excuse me. And why not? And if a date is going badly and your dopamine levels are decreasing, you're probably already imagining, whether it's at a cinema or theater, wherever you are, you're probably already imagining, yeah, I'm never going to talk to this person ever again.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I'll get somebody else who's going to light my brain up.
Yeah.
And we all do that. The problem, though, is this. When will people realize that what they have is good enough? Because when I was doing pre-marriage courses, like 10 years ago, when you ask people how did they meet, it was through work in the local bar. It was never through a dating app, never. Now, you know, the amount of times people will say that they've met through an app is increasing because the shame is kind of reducing. But not always, because I was at a Bill Burr comedy gig 2 years ago in the Three Arenas. It was packed, completely sold out.
Yeah.
And everybody laughed at every joke he made, except he made one comment about how many of us here in the audience were on Tinder. And the whole room stopped laughing completely. It was like maybe 5,000 people, whatever number was there, just stopped. And it's like, you could hear a pin drop. It's like, oh my God, we're all so collectively ashamed of being on Tinder. And he just looked at the crowd and was like, what's wrong with you people? Oh my God. It's where I asked you, have you committed a crime or something? You know, so there's that to it too. So I think we're progressing, but we're still a little bit shame based around, oh, I'm on a dating app.
So tied to progression then, like, do you feel that, do you think there's anything wrong if somebody goes on Tinder, let's say, and they're not looking for anything, they're not looking for a relationship or anything, it's more for the sexual side of things? But my ultimate question here would be, does it need to end in a relationship, like long term? Should that be for, like, what you were talking about, dopamine levels, the pleasure principle, should the long-term goal always be a relationship, or can people freely use dating apps for the rest of their life, for example?
Oh, they can, absolutely.
Yeah.
The question is, in terms of the quality of relationships that they will learn about over a 20-year period of having multiple casual sex encounters. We do know that casual sex, while it's very enjoyable, long term isn't necessarily a viable lifestyle option, because it gives us pleasure but doesn't give us contentment.
Yep.
So that's, again, if you look at how pornography has affected our understanding of relationships, pornography is objectification, it's very dismissive, it's instantaneous, it's all these wonderful things in terms of pleasure. But I've yet to meet a man who tells me that he watches pornography and feels contented afterwards. He may have masturbated, but that's an orgasm, which is pleasure. But to actually continuously watch pornography and have that kind of a casual sex encounter, very few people find contentment in that.
Mm.
Because you never get to the other phases of relationship development, which is the pair bonding piece. You have the mating, but not pair bonding. And that's what happily successful couples have. They have the ability to sit in silence, not speak. They have the ability to look at each other and just by a glance know what the other person's thinking and feeling. They have a whole range of skill sets that somebody who is addicted, shall we say, to casual sex or loves casual sex will never really have with anybody. they'll never be known, and they will never know true intimacy. They'll have amazing sexual encounters, and they'll have no bedpost stuff because they'll have that many notches in them, which is fine. But ultimately, they may never know what it's like to be loved. Mm. And I think that human nature is a desire. Our goal as humans is to be loved and to be truly known by somebody else. And dating apps don't necessarily help us to be truly known by somebody else.
Is addiction common in your practice?
Well, addiction. Yeah, well, I specifically work with sex and porn addicts, so it would be fairly common.
Because those statistics, I think, would be something that would be put under the carpet a lot as well, where people wouldn't speak about it. So,
and like teenagers. So, I mean, the teenage brain is in crisis.
Yeah.
Because we have teenagers who, through as a consequence of COVID, have been allowed to sit upstairs or in their bedrooms on their phones all day watching pornography if they so choose to do so. And I have so many couples that I work with who are parents. I'm like, can your kids access porn? Oh, God, I don't know. Well, have they access to the internet? Have you filters on their internet access? No, I don't. So yeah, they can access pornography. Well, they could, I suppose, but I don't think they are. The Irish parents are just in cloud cuckoo land if they don't think their children are watching pornography. And if those kids are watching porn, they're going to be addicted to it. Not everybody, but a large proportion of teenagers, because the male brain particularly, cannot cope with that level of stimulation to a drug and not be addicted to that very same drug.
Yeah. So this is a perfect segue, because this is a question I had. Your book delves into technology and child development. What advice would you give to parents about managing that, as you mentioned, addictive nature of technology?
Yeah, so I'm not very popular in certain circles because
good.
Yeah, but my advice is very clear. Why does your child have access to a tablet or a smartphone or to gaming? Why are you giving your child that access? And people will often say, oh, sure, they love it. I know they love it, but if they loved heroin, would you give them heroin? Probably not. Well, it's the same impact on the child's brain. Mm. If you let a child be stimulated by technology, it's creating neural pathways where they no longer feel happy just playing with their friends. They no longer feel happy just being creative and making up games in their minds or playing with their teddy bears or whatever. And we're basically allowing children's brains to be transformed irrevocably by technological surges of chemicals that are far too powerful for the average brain to cope with.
Yeah.
And parents, through a lack of education by the Irish government, let's be honest, I mean, who controls education? The government and media perhaps as well. But parents are not aware of or don't want to know about how dangerous it is for young people to have access to technology.
Mm.
And they say, well, you know, I often hear people saying, well, we only let them have it for 2 hours a day. I'm going, yeah, 20 minutes is too long, not 2 hours. Don't think you're doing your child a great service because your friends next door let the kids on for 6 hours. 20 minutes maximum.
So the argument to that, it's, I would say, it could partially come from a place of last alternative, like you have a child rolling on the floor begging to go on social media, to go on Instagram or Snapchat. What's the alternative? Like, how do you parent that situation?
You tell the child, no, you're really sorry, but it's really bad for them. The same way after a child has had an ice cream and they say, I want more ice cream. You say, no, it's really bad for you. Let's have a conversation about why it's bad for you.
Mm.
And you tell the child, unless the child is like 0 to 1, you know, your 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old is going to have a basic understanding of what being bad for them means.
Yeah.
Like, don't put your hand in the fire. It's bad for you. You know, you can put the hand's child close to the fire, but not into the fire. Children, depending on their age, can understand a huge amount of what we tell them if we tell it to them in the right way.
Okay.
So use education as opposed to coercive, controlling parenting techniques or strategies. Just be honest with your kids. Look, it's really bad for you to have that, so I'm not giving it to you.
Hmm.
I mean, I know of 10-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds that go on play dates to their friends' houses. And you know what they do at the play date? Give a guess what they do at the play date.
They're on their phone.
No, they're sitting down on the couch watching their friend play PlayStation for 5 hours. They don't even play the game.
Mm.
So their friend is on playing Fortnite, for example, or whatever. Completely inappropriate. But they're on a game and the child just sits there for 5 hours on the couch.
Yeah.
Since when is that a valid, authentic play date? Mm. Oh my God, what's wrong with Irish parents?
And now I'm going to move. So you've recently set up Headwise, which helps teens meditate. So this ties in probably nicely with the technology aspect. Why is meditation important for teens?
Okay, so I thought you were going to ask me, how come you're telling people not to use devices, and yet they have to access your course through a device, which is a better question. Because the kids are on technology for so much of the day, or and nights as well, God love them, their brains are wired towards stimulation. What they really need is to learn to exist without that stimulation. They need to understand that it's okay to sit with yourself for 3 minutes and do nothing.
Yeah.
They need to understand that when they're stressed or suffering from anxiety, the answer is not to look at TikTok or to check how many likes their last post on Facebook has had. The answer is to sit with themselves and to breathe through their anxiety or through their distress, as the case may be. So the mindfulness course that we've created is based on the traditional principles of mindfulness, but it allows children and teenagers to just take stock of what's going on in their lives, whether it's mindful eating, which is luckily for them a square of chocolate, or it's mindful walking out in the garden where you don't need your smartphone, you don't need any device. And what we're doing is we're giving them a set of principles and habits and tools that they can use without technology to allow themselves to reflect on what they're really feeling and thinking, which as a teenager, I think is a very important skill set. You know, if you have an argument with your parents because they won't let you go to the local teenage disco and you're very upset and angry, rather than going on and, you know, complaining about your parents to all your friends on social media, actually just letting yourself have the emotion and realizing that you are not that emotion. You know, I'm angry now, but, you know, they're probably doing it for my best, you know, for my best interests. And I'm not angry. I won't always be angry. And to let that emotion just happen and wash over them is a far better way than lashing out and trying to organize and strategize around how they can get to the disco and usurp their parents' authority in the house. There's so many ways that mindfulness can help teenagers. It's my job to try and get them to understand how it can be of benefit. That's the goal really of the program.
And so it just came to me there, it ties in closely then with relationships as well. Is it something you'd recommend to couples as well, meditation? Is it ever something you'd advise for a husband, wife to do?
Absolutely. And we have an online program called Relationship Bootcamp. And in Relationship Bootcamp, we have a whole module on sex and sexuality. And in that, we talk about mindful lovemaking. Because again, people watch pornography, you know, couples watch pornography and they think that that's what they're supposed to replicate. And they're never fully in touch with their breathing during sex. They're never really in touch with the idea of touching each other in a sensual way. Because what happens in the typical Irish sex life is people learn certain techniques through various different sexual experiences and they apply those techniques to various different people until they have the last person they're going to be with. And then they never change those techniques. They never adapt them. They never even ask their partners, do you like this technique? Is this actually good for you?
Yeah.
And as a consequence of that, very often people disengage sexually. So they might be having the physical act of sex, but psychologically in their minds, they're not connected to each other at all. He's probably thinking about somebody else. She's thinking about the fact that she has to get up early in the morning and bring the kids to school.
Yeah.
And there's a dentist appointment at 10 o'clock. So they're having sex, but they're not connected.
Mm.
So we talk about mindfulness in terms of how you can reconnect sexually. It's super important for couples to just take time and learn those basic techniques.
And so let's move back to the relationships aspect. In your book, you talk a lot about the role of willpower in relationships. Can you expand a bit more on this?
Yeah, so willpower, some scientists have believed, now I think it's been debunked, but there has been a belief that in some way willpower is connected to glucose, that if we have low glucose levels in our blood sugars, that we are less likely to be able to resist difficult challenges or temptations. So, for example, if your partner says something to you that you really dislike, it kind of really frustrates you, gets your wick up, you're just not happy with it, and you've eaten your lunch, and you're perfectly satiated, and you're biologically you're content, you may be much more likely to sit on your frustration, sit on your annoyance, and say nothing to your partner till, you know, a better time. If you're really, really hungry, because it's pre-lunchtime, and somebody criticizes you, you're quite likely to go off the rails completely and vent and then have a major conflict. So what couples don't realize is that a huge amount of the arguments we have are connected to the hormones that we are experiencing at that time. If it's a surge of testosterone or estrogen, our low blood sugars or cortisol, we will act out accordingly. So willpower is one of those things where we need to learn to build it up as a muscle. So we build up willpower by saying nothing when we ordinarily would have said something.
Yeah.
And what happens is when you say something and you haven't really thought about what you're saying, then you're causing chaos. And yeah. Chaos is never good in a relationship.
Mm. So this would be similar to biofeedback, that type of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
People are familiar. Okay. Now, next question. So you're also the founder of MindLab, which provides applied neuroscience workshops to companies. What type of applied neuroscience do you teach in these workshops? I know I don't want you to give too much away, but just...
So, good question. Thank you for asking. So effectively, we're trying to encourage companies to understand the basic principles of how their employees and their managers' brains work and to use that information to engage more effectively with those employees and with their customers. So I try to focus as well on the neuromarketing perspective, where if you understand why people buy when they buy, what they are looking for, then you can sell more effectively to them. And the old traditional understanding of how why we buy what we buy, that's changing. So we now recognize more in relation to, people buy when they want something as opposed to when they need it, when it has certain color schemes, when it has a certain saliency or a relevance to the person. Those kind of cues towards purchasing something are much more unconscious than we realize. Mm. And also things like priming, where we are affected by our environment and by the sequence of words that we read on a website, for example, or in a brochure. All those things can impact on whether or not somebody chooses to buy your service or your product or not, as the case may be. So it's about helping companies understand the various complex layers of the brain, how it works, but to do so in a very simplistic way, so it's accessible to everybody, because neuroscience is quite dense and quite full of lofty but very engaging ideals. But if you're of a certain academic level, and we try to make neuroscience in that way much more accessible.
Mm. Okay. And then I just have one more question. We're almost there, David. I ask this to all my guests. We've already briefly talked about this, but if you could give one piece of advice that could go to the next generation, like changing the education system, what you find that is really, really important for children and the next generation to find meaning in life, what would that be?
Okay, I would suggest that if I could speak to every teenager in the country, I would suggest that they challenge the assumptions that society has helped them to form when they get to 18. I mean, between 18 and 25, challenge those assumptions.
Mm. So kind of like critical thinking.
Critical thinking, which yeah. I don't think we actually encourage in schools. We encourage in schools passive thinking. Regurgitate what I've told you and I'll give you an A. That's not acceptable anymore. I don't think any major corporation wants a young person to come into their employment and just regurgitate what they've been told. They want young people to think for themselves.
Yeah.
And the universities will tell students, I'm giving you A and B. You have to figure out what C and D is. Where students are like, but I can just tell you what A and B is because you've told me.
Yeah.
Now, unless you tell me what C and D is, I can't tell you back.
Yeah.
That's a problem. So challenge assumptions and learn to think for yourselves.
Perfect. And finally, where can people find you, David?
So if you just Google the name David Kavanagh, psychotherapist, a number of the websites will come up, based on the various different categories of work that I do and who's looking for me.
Perfect. And I'll be sure to include your book, your website, and more on Headwise and MindLab as well in the show notes. Thank you very, very much for doing this.
My pleasure.